All right, everybody. This is Matthew Aaron. I'm here with Sunil Perkesh and Hillary is joining me again. I'm going to let Hillary do her introduction in a moment, but you could follow us on Twitter at The Matt Aaron Show, at Matt Aaron Show, The Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. We're on Blog Talk Radio at The Matthew Aaron Show, but where we've been getting a ton of listens lately, and I've been kind of telling people it's the easiest and best way to listen to the show is Spotify and Apple Podcasts, but especially Spotify. We blew up on Spotify. I'm very grateful for that. And I think it was the Dave Hemmingson episode a few months ago that got 30,000 listens in a week, and people just really started gravitating to Spotify. While we're all self-isolating, I've just decided to put out as many of these podcasts as we can, keep you guys entertained, give you guys something to do in case you're bored sitting around the house. Sunil, of course, is a world-famous producer who we will get to in a moment, but we're going to start with Hillary. Hillary, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell everybody a little something about you.
Sure. Hey, I'm Hillary Barraford. I am a very proud multi-hyphenate actress, producer, all around, a little bit of a writer myself. So I guess just a creative storyteller. And I'm from Boston. And yes, I am devastated that Tom Brady has left us. So that's a little fun fact about me. I'm having a hard time.
He's a Buccaneer
right now.
He's a Buccaneer. Have you talked to Chiklis at all about it?
It's like the worst. I'm like, you had to go to Florida?
Did you text Hillary, did you text Chiklis about it? Has he said anything about it?
I haven't texted Chiklis about it.
He's got to be heartbroken, right? Because, I mean, that was his man crush.
It is his man crush. He texts with Tom all the time. I'm sure he knew about it long before any of us knew about it, actually. Wow. But yeah, Michael's daughter has just returned from her study abroad junior year in London. So I think he's focused on making sure that she's disease free. So
well,
I'm going to give him a pass.
That's fair.
Situation.
Well, Sunil, I'm very excited to speak with you. He has produced two blockbuster films you've definitely are aware of and have probably seen, Salt and Enchanted. And he has a new film out right now, Video on Demand, which is perfect during this self-isolation. Video on Demand is your best friend right now with Spy Intervention. Yep. With Drew Van Acker. And it's a really funny movie about it's about spies, which it's kind of in the vein of a Mr. and Mrs. Smith to a degree. It's about a guy who kind of retires from being a spy and is living the suburban life, and it doesn't exactly go well for him. And you could catch that right now. It's on Video on Demand. Sunil, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's a nice Friday afternoon to talk on the phone. Perfect day to do this.
How have you been isolating, sir, in your week or so far of doing this? Like, what have you been doing with your time?
I mean, I'm still working from home. Obviously, there is so much uncertainty as to when things are going to, you know, be back to whatever normal is, but you're trying, you know, your best to continue moving all your projects forward so that when things are back, we can jump on it. I believe very strongly, like, you know, when we can actually help the economy and everybody, we all should, you know. Yeah. Like, I would hate to see this move to the next stage where we can and we're not ready for it. I encourage everybody to, like, you know, not use this as a moment to, you know, lull yourself to sort of zombieism, but, like, you know, be productive, get things done, both business, personal, all of those things.
Yeah, Hillary and I feel, you know, really, like, I called Hillary earlier in the week and I said, how do we turn these lemons into lemonade? And she and I decided, let's put out a ton of podcasts. I'll keep writing. We have a couple features we're taking out. We have a TV show that it's the best thing I've ever done, and I'm so in love with it. And I really, really, really hope someone gets attached to it. To make it, because so we're just right now, like, let's get as prepped as we can so when this is over, we got the projects, we got the connections, we got the network. Let's go out there and take some meetings and try to get something made. And I think that's the best thing in our business that we can do right now.
Absolutely. I haven't read the article, but apparently there's an op-ed by Tom Rothman, the head of Sony, saying that he believes very strongly that the demand for film and television and entertainment will be stronger than ever because the pipeline has literally stopped right now. This has never happened before where, you know, nothing is going into production. And, you know, I think we can all safely say it's nothing is going to go for a couple of months at minimum, probably longer. I've heard some people say after the 4th of July. I've had others say after September. And so, you know, that pipeline will have to be filled a huge way because, you know, everybody who's watching everything right now is probably literally watching everything. It's that people who have the list of 80 movies I've always wanted to see before I die are actually having an opportunity to do that.
Well,
maybe they should add 800 movies that they want to see before they die.
God, I hope not. But I will say, I mean, this people tend to have short memories. After 9/11, there was a little bit of a period, but for this business, the writer's strike of 2007 went on long enough that all the networks and all the movie studios basically had to buy up a ton of scripts just in case nothing was going to get made during that period. And there was a time where things weren't getting made. And I kind of feel like this will be a more extreme version of that once we get out of this period, which is there's going to need to be a lot of content that and people, when they do have money again, are going to look towards film and TV to spend their time because it's not going to a ball game that's going to cost you $200. It's we've always been kind of recession proof this industry, and I hope that continues after this. That's the hope.
Absolutely, with entertainment. So, look, and again, even things like Netflix, you know, what's on their Netflix, they're not going to be, you know, it's harder for them to put new stuff on, although maybe they'll make deals with older films or something, but there will definitely be a demand for film like there's no tomorrow. So, absolutely, I'm doing what everybody else and what you guys are doing, which is moving things as much along as you can, you know.
Yeah.
I think in a few weeks we'll just have a better sense of it. It all sort of went from zero to a million last week, and I think everybody's a little bit shell-shocked about everything happening.
Or even last night.
Or even last night, yeah. In Los Angeles, exactly, and it's and I think there's so many uncertainties about what drugs may or may not work. Does this malaria drug work or not? I just think in the next week or two, you know, when everyone catches up, we'll have a better sense, which will hopefully help our abilities to get as much done in a productive manner, so we can hit the ground running. Because, boy, the world will have a huge demand for entertainment, and we should be ready.
Yeah, I don't want to dwell on worst case scenario, but as someone who's been through it all, and from big budget movies to passion projects, if this thing goes on for 12 months, what's going to happen? Do you have any idea what we're looking at?
I don't personally think it can go on for 12 months for a gazillion reasons, which I won't bore you with.
Sure.
I think ultimately, my understanding is this is to flatten a curve. I read a thing about from doctors at UCSF that, to contain it would take 12 to 18 months, but you would probably destroy life as we know it. And I would be surprised if it went on that long, because that I don't think anybody's intention was to eradicate this virus, because they were, you know, trying to, you know, how do you flatten the curve and manage it? And, you know, some would say you can never eradicate it. So, you know, we don't know. I don't think it will go that long, because I'm not sure society as we know it would survive with that. But I've read those articles too. But again, I think let's see where the next week or two go. You know, I'm my doctor parents, they're retired. They're very, very encouraged by what they're reading about the malaria drugs. Again, they haven't seen the studies, but what they're reading online and what doctor friends of theirs are telling them, they're just very, very encouraged. My dad would say that, even aside, within a month or two, there would be an antiviral drug probably in 4 to 6 months some sort of vaccine. And, you know, in the process, we will have flattened the curve so we don't overwhelm healthcare, which is really what this is about. I think the media has, you know, turned this into a sort of, you know, we've got to beat the virus. It's a virus. It doesn't, it's not like there's a moment where it surrenders to us like
yeah.
a war.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not a doctor, so I really don't have much of an opinion on it, but I will say I was talking to Hillary the other day, and I told her, I'm like, you know, they're finding a lot of malaria-esque symptoms to this process, and so it only makes sense that they've been testing malaria vaccines and drugs on it. So hopefully this all gets figured out, and we can move on. And like I said, for anyone sitting at home that's in the entertainment business or wants to be in the entertainment business, now is your time to prep as much stuff as you can prep. Prep your best material. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, remember, the writers left their agents about a year ago.
Yep.
So if I was a writer, I would write a spec script, something commercial and fun. Maybe right now is not the time to write like something, you know, gloom and doomy,
yeah.
but fun. But by the way, Contagion is like the most on iTunes. It's like the second most rented thing. So there you go. It's a good time to create because you have the power to create. And ultimately, that's what we do as filmmakers. We create.
Now, you are I got to tell you, when Hillary told me that you were still working in this business in the 90s, I'm like, but he looks so young. He's so good looking. I was shocked that you've been doing this as long as you've been doing it. How did you start out in the 90s doing what you're doing?
He was a baby.
He must have been.
I graduated in 91 from Stanford University with a degree in economics and communication. And at 22, I dreamed of making movies. I knew I wanted to make movies from probably junior high on. And while I majored in econ and communications, communications had a filmmaking, like I actually made a Super 8 film in a class. I had film history, and then on the side, I took like 8 English classes, which was fiction and storytelling, and I knew I wanted to like make movies, films like Star Wars, Gone with the Wind, Ten Commandments, E.T., Jaws. Those were like my favorite films, and even I'd throw Sound and Music in there. So many of those like big, entertaining, mainstream epics I just loved growing up as a kid. And, you know, my senior year at Stanford, I saw Dances with Wolves in a theater 3 times, and I said, I have to go to L.A. and pursue this dream. My parents were doctors. My brother was a freshman at Columbia Med School. He'd gone to Stanford undergrad. And through a friend of mine, my senior dorm, her father in New York had a producer friend. He's not a major name that people have heard of, but he was, you know, he had a project at Hollywood Pictures back then, which was Disney,
yep.
And he was making a film in Mexico, and I came and worked as his assistant for like $250 for a week, for a year. And that year, I learned so much about what it means to, like, succeed in Hollywood. I realized right away half of this is who you know. While I had a Stanford degree, people cared, but they didn't. It's networking. It's figuring out how to get on the inside of a system that's a little bit tough to get inside, even in the early 90s. And during that year, he had a project, Hollywood Pictures, which is Disney. I met an executive there. And that was good. I actually met someone kind of in power, and we made a little film, and this is what nobody knows. The director, first-time director, and the movie actually sat on the shelf quite a bit before it was, like, you know, discovered, but the film was Kronos by Guillermo del Toro. So
wow.
I was there driving wow. Guillermo del Toro around in 1991, Los Angeles. He shot it in Mexico. We did the post up here. And even that film sat on the shelf before Jim Cameron saw it quite some time later. I may be getting it slightly wrong, not that much later, but it was, I remember Jim Cameron saw it, and that's what got it noticed. And I realized back then, man, this is not an industry that's easy. You need connections and networking. And I actually quit my job after a year and started freelance reading. And in that time, I had a lot of assistant friends from Stanford, and they were all at like various agencies and, you know, starting at the bottom of the food chain. And I got very entrenched into their little social world. And in the meantime, I started like meeting young writers and liking the scripts. I'm reading freelance for money. And then I'm also doing something which I sort of pride myself, which I just self-taught myself. Friends of mine at like ICM Assistance would send me 40 scripts a week. This sold for $1 million to Paramount. Tom Cruise attached themselves to this. And I literally probably on my own in a year read thousands of scripts to get a sense of like what sells a spec script. Because everybody back then was saying, if you can find a young writer who can write a script that's not in the system, that's how you become a producer. Like, find what we can't bring to the table. And I started meeting young writers. And then on another note, I went to every AFI, UCLA extension, any class I could go to where mainstream Hollywood studio execs would speak, I would go. I would always write them a letter after and see if they would meet me for 5 minutes. You know, half did, half didn't. It would always be like a meeting set 3 weeks later. And this was all done by mail back then. Like, there was no email. So it was a lot of effort to write the letter, get the letter back, or a call from their office. And then I would go and say, you know, I'm meeting young writers. Would you ever read any of my scripts? And everybody was pretty much like, sure, you know, you're going to need a bigger producer, but yeah, find a script, send it to us. And that's kind of how I started. And I, early on, a bunch of young writers, I developed their scripts, and then I started sending them out, and people liked them. The first one I sold was Kurt Wimmer, who ended up writing Salt years later. Yeah. I developed a script called Second Defense, and we sold it to New Line. New Line paid Kurt $400,000, and I was suddenly at 24 years old on the front page of Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, EPing a film with Arnold Copelson, who back then had produced The Fugitive and Seven, and, you know, was in Platoon and was a big A-list producer. And that just launched me at 24, smack in the middle of the mainstream business, where I just, you know, you just, you know, instantly meet everybody. Then I developed a script called Looking for Eve, which became, I sold it in 94 to New Line as well. It, later on became my first film that went into production called Blast from the Past.
Yeah.
But like a month after we...
My favorite.
Mm-hmm. A month after we sold it. Oh, it's Jim Carrey was attached to it. I sold a script with Rennie Harlan attached to New Line that they paid the writer Kurt Wimmer $1 million for.
Oh.
Then I developed another Kurt Wimmer script that suddenly everyone in town, even Spielberg, met with Kurt on it. We ended up setting it up at UA. But at this point, you know, I was well on my way to setting up projects everywhere. And through those years, I had movies at Paramount with Scott Rudin. I had movies at DreamWorks, two projects at DreamWorks. But it wasn't, what was interesting was I wasn't making movies. I was a young, buzzing producer, quote unquote, with all these cool projects, but movies weren't getting made. And it wasn't until 98 where Blast actually got into production at New Line with Brendan Fraser, Alicia Silverstone, Hillary's, you know, I think that's your, you know,
it's my favorite guilty pleasure of all time. I love that movie. It's when you want to feel good about, like, I should watch it now. When you want to feel good about the world, you watch that movie.
It's a very entertaining movie, you know, and it did perfectly fine. It did well for New Line. But weirdly, Hollywood was in such a turmoil at that point where all these like selling specs and having projects you're developing, I had like 8 or 9 things around town, that started to slightly go away. And what everyone was saying was you got to focus on a few movies, push them into production. And from 2003 to 2005, I really put all my focus into Premonition and Enchanted. And we finally, after I sold Enchanted in the 90s, finally, 8 years later, we had all these writers had written on it. I went back to the original writer. He went back to his April 98 draft. This is 2004. And in 6 weeks, he actually got the draft that was greenlit. And, you know, we have this brilliant director, Kevin Lima, come on board with a real vision for the film. And that was greenlit. And then weirdly, simultaneously, Premonition was a project I had with Hyde Park, Ashok Amritraj. And that started to come together when TriStar Sony came in for domestic. And so the two movies went right after each other. Premonition went in Shreveport. I went to Shreveport. I was there every day as a producer. Sandra Bullock starred in Premonition. We wrapped, and shortly thereafter, I went to New York to do Enchanted. And it was one of the most interesting experiences of my life. I learned so much being on the ground as a producer. I creatively developed these scripts, and I did put the movies together, you know, packaging them with the agents and the studio and all of that. But actually really being the guy, you know, in production was fascinating. Obviously, Premonition was a big hit. Back then, it was Sandy's biggest opening, I think, at $18 million. We did $50 domestically. Enchanted became a massive, massive worldwide blockbuster. Yeah. I will never, ever, ever forget how it was tracking in the toilet. The ad campaign wasn't working. We were tracking to open between 12 and 15 for the 3 days on Thanksgiving, maybe 15 wow. to 18 for the five. And at the 11th hour, when the critics saw it, we were 96 or 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, with virtually every critic giving it 4 out of 5 stars or 5 out of 5 stars. I remember the LA Times had a front page picture of Amy Adams with a big headline, Enchanted, colon, absolutely, and a glowing review. And we just ballooned to $34 million for the 3 days and $50 million opening number one. And we went on to do $340 million. Won so many awards. I went to like all these award shows and just what a, and I created that movie with Bill Kelly from scratch. By the way, all my movies I develop early on, and yeah. it's so gratifying. We're again, sitting in an apartment with nothing more than your creativity. You create all that. In the, just before Enchanted, came out earlier that year, maybe in early 2007, I had this project I developed with Kurt Wimmer that had some starts, stops. We, for a minute, were set up at Rogue Pictures. We were going to maybe do it with Jason Statham, maybe not. It fell apart. It was just sitting there, this 8-year-old script that I loved that nobody seemed to like. And I gave it to a friend of mine, Hannah Minghella, who was working with Amy Pascal, and we were working on Premonition because it was now, you know, the Sony side of it was releasing the film. And Amy and Hannah flipped over it, and suddenly there was a weird, like a script that had been around, there was a bidding war, and they ended up paying Kurt Wimmer $2.8 million for the script.
Wow.
And the profile that went on that script was huge, and very soon Tom Cruise was attached to it, Philip Noyce, who is another brilliant filmmaker, was attached yeah. to it, and it didn't end up working out with Tom, but very quickly Angelina came on board, and you know, we were in production in New York. I was there every day working on that film, and again, it became a worldwide blockbuster at, you know, $300 million worldwide gross, and a lot of fun to make, and that was sort of my trajectory of these bigger studio films. You know, it's interesting, guys. After Salt is when the studio system in Hollywood took another weird change, which is, you know, nobody seemed to want to make, you know, spec scripts anymore the way they used to. Everything turned to IP and, you know, remakes and superheroes. And by 2010, 11, 12, I had an Enchanted sequel in development at Disney, a Salt sequel at Sony. I'd sold a pilot to ABC. I had a project with Philip Noyce at Relativity that was at any moment about to go. And so I had 4 profile projects. And by 2013, 14, none of them were happening. And I started to realize this is not where my future is. It's radically shifted. I have so many people who, friends of mine, who've left the business because they don't know how to get movies made. There was a flood into TV. I've tried TV, and to be honest, I would do television if it's something I love, but I've always had a criteria. I've got to love it or I don't want to do it. And, you know, I don't want to do TV the way there are plenty of really talented and really established people doing television that I don't want to compete with. It doesn't mean I couldn't, I just don't want to. And so I was focusing on features, and I realized I need to make an independent film and show people that I know how to make a film outside of this system that can still see the light of day. And I went and raised money, and the first film I did independently was Divorce Party, starring Tom Cockrell, Matilda sure. Lutz, Claire Holt. And it ended up getting a distribution deal with Gravitas, 10 cities theatrically. We got a rave review in the LA Times last year. And it's a charming, charming little film with this brilliant director named Will Thompson out of New York. He was 26 years old when he directed it. No profile in Hollywood. The cast was all up-and-comers. You know, Tom Cockrell, he's on an HBO show, so talented. You know, what a pleasure to make a little film like that. And as I was doing that, I sort of was developing a few more scripts where suddenly I'm like, wait a minute, why don't I make this one for a small amount right after? Let me use some of the same investors. Let me raise the money again through my connections. So 6 months after Divorce Party wrapped, I did a film called, it's called Lifelike, starring Drew Van Acker, Addison Timlin, Stephen Strait, and James Darcy. And actually, on a side note, that's where I met Hillary, because she played a character named Ronald, who's actually a co-lead of the film. She played his wife.
Ronald's wife. Yeah, Mark Famoletti.
Mark Famoletti, who actually wrote Divorce Party with Lane Garrison and Spy, and he played a role. And there it all, like, you know, it's beautiful how it all synergized together. Lifelike is a really cool little film, very, very unique, and it ended up selling to Lionsgate. They distributed it last year. It's available everywhere on iTunes, on Amazon, all of those platforms. Really, really, really kind of a twisted, turny sci-fi thriller. And the whole idea with all these movies, again, was to, like, establish and create new talent, both in actors, writers, directors, all of it. They're all three first-time writers. Second-time writer was for Spy. All three first-time directors, none of whom had any profile or, like, you know, visibility within Hollywood. In doing Lifelike, meeting Drew Van Acker, he was on Pretty Little Liars before, I was blown away that you got this, like, movie star Brad Pitt sort of vibe, but he can act. Not only can he act, he's a brilliant actor. He's so present in the scenes, 3 to 4 takes, and he would nail it, and it really, really impressed me. A little story, let me back up, which is when we put Amy Adams in Enchanted, she had not had her Oscar nod for Junebug, and it was a tough sell to Disney back then. She was, you know, she'd been in a lot of stuff, but she wasn't a named star. And you guys know how Hollywood loves named stars, not, right. Oh, this is a really creatively good choice. And Kevin Lima auditioned her. Her audition wasn't good. It was a 10 out of a 10. We fought very hard. Disney said yes. And literally a month before production, she got an Oscar nod for Junebug. And a lot of people said, by casting her the previous October in an $80 million film, you actually created visibility in Junebug to get her that Oscar nod. I'm not saying that's the case, but it was definitely maybe a thing where A helps B helps C. When I met Van Acker, he was as good as Amy Adams. And I'm like, this is a movie star like I haven't seen in a long time. And I've worked with stars. And there's, you know, there's two things I think movie stars have. They have an X factor that people are drawn to. And then, you know, they know how to act. They have the craft of acting. And again, you know, one of my favorite actors outside of Amy Adams I've worked with is Sissy Spacek, who is just so method and just transforms herself. You know, all of them do. Sandra Bullock, Angelina, they're all a pleasure to work with because they're so strong on that set. And then here was Drew Van Acker, that good. Right after we wrapped, I gave him Spy. It was an old script. And I said, dude, we're going to put this together, make it for a budget. And literally within 3 months, we were in production. Wow. I actually want to tell a funny story about how I met the brilliant young director, Drew Milrae. I met him on an airplane or in a lounge at San Jose Airport, and he was writing a script, and it turned out he's a commercial director. And a few months later, when I was looking for a director for Spy, I didn't love who the agencies and managers were sending me. I called this kid up, and he blew us out of the water with this very artsy yet accessible take of, like, I don't want to compete with studio movies. Let me take a more Wes Anderson vibe, which was, he did a 3-minute little reel. And in that 3-minute reel that he did, we raised the money. A.V. Kaufman cast the film, and we ended up making the film 3 months later with Poppy Delevingne, who's fantastic, Blake Anderson, Brittany Ferlin, who is just an utter comic genius, Max Silvestri, hilarious. Natasha Bassett, Lane Garrison's in the film. It's such a fun film. And, you know, when you look at Lifelike and then Spy and see what an interesting actor Van Acker is and what a, you know, it's Spy Intervention is pure entertainment, but like Enchanted, it actually has real themes of like adventure versus security. I love the idea of entertainment, but underneath it, there's a foundation and there's a smarts to it and an artistry to it that's very curated. You know, I'm a huge fan of everyone from Hitchcock to Spielberg to, well, Del Toro. I love the idea of a curated vision and thematic underpinnings and real storytelling and character journeys that, while completely fun, there's something underneath it all. And so, you know, I'm so proud of Spy Intervention. You know, we all poured our hearts and soul into it. And the movie's original and different and bold. And again, here's a director with no profile before this, with a cast that everybody said has no business model, and we ended up having Endeavor Content rep the film. We were shortlisted till the very last second at Sundance, South by Tribeca in London, and we ended up having multiple offers for domestic distribution, Cinedigm being the coming in with the best offer, and we're in the process of selling it all over the world. We have deals closed in UK, Greece, China, South Africa, Portugal, and there are a few others I'm missing, and more to come. And so, again, all three of these films that everyone said to me, you don't make films with a director we've never heard of and a cast like that. I made them. They're getting out there. They're getting great distribution deals, and that was the fun of making these, with Spy being the one I'm probably just what we accomplished for the just very little money is just impressive on every level.
That's great. I mean, what I'm getting from this, though, is as a producer, and for anyone out there who's an up-and-coming filmmaker or producer, the best thing you can do is build your network, is meet people, is read, get good material, meet talented people, and then kind of, you know, don't be afraid to use those friendships, pitch things around town, and you just kind of ride the right wave, whichever, you know, whatever's working.
Absolutely. One thing years and years and years ago, Judy Jacobs, and back then, I met her when she was at Universal, then she went to DreamWorks, and then she ran Disney when she greenlit Enchanted. She's gone on to produce Crazy Rich Asians, Hunger Games, one of the smartest, classiest class acts I've met in Hollywood. Cannot say enough good things about her and how much I learned from her back in the day. But Nina always said to me one thing, which was, bring me the best material, Sunil. Don't ever, ever, you know, bring me anything that you don't believe is the best, because that's how you define yourself. And that's another big thing that I sort of abide by, which is make sure what you're putting out there competes in the marketplace. And, you know, every studio, every company that makes movies, they have plenty of people they know well that are bringing them product. And so if you don't know them well, figure out a way that your material or what you're bringing to the table is more exciting. I have always bet from the beginning on my taste. You know, whether it's Amy Adams, whether it's Drew Van Acker, whether it's, you know, Drew Milrae, who directed Spy, Will Thompson, who directed Divorce Party. But these are all people that when I met them, I'm like, there's something really, really talented there. They know their stuff really well. They understand filmmaking. They understand all of it. And I'm going to back it. And that's the thing I always say to people is, you know, back stuff. But if it doesn't work, how do I say this? Like, there is a marketplace I find in Hollywood. Figure out how you can compete in it in the best way possible. I actually think the mistake I see most people making is they want to get to the finish line without quite, you know, understanding the root of how you get there, which is, you know, it's people have limited slots. Even when you're selling a finished film, like an independent film today, to get one of the big agencies to rep your film is never easy. One of my favorite moments on Spy was everybody said you're never going to get one of the big agencies to rep it, and a agent at Endeavor Content screened it, and that email I got right after, I loved it, exclamation point. What number are you at? You know, that's what you want. And it's, and I learned this many, many years ago. I just want to back up and say that, like, before I started selling my spec scripts, that first 6 months back in the early 90s, I probably met some writers, probably found some scripts. It's not that they weren't good, but I thought they were great. They weren't competing in the marketplace. And I actually remember people saying to me back then, you know, you've got to get a sense of what the marketplace is. And that's why I set off to have all my assistant friends send me what was selling all over town so that, you know, everything is, how does my movie, my scripts compare to what's selling to Paramount, what's selling to Universal? And then today, it's the same thing. When you're out trying to cast a movie, you know, how is this better than other stuff? Because, you know, everybody, how do you create noise on your thing to pop, to make something pop, you know?
Right.
Exactly.
That's sort of my big two cents of the day. You know, it's just not what everybody thinks it is. That's sort of my two cents. And I say that actually, you know, Hillary knows this about me, is I love giving advice, but I love giving advice that I actually believe helps people. I actually, like in my conspiracy theories, I believe so many people give people advice to almost like keep them down and keep them up. I'm half kidding.
You're half kidding. Well, that's only half kidding, because in L.A. that feels sometimes it's. Trust me. I don't know if it's a total conspiracy theory.
Yeah. It's a conspiracy theory because sometimes. I was a true outsider. I did not know anybody in this business. And it's not easy to get to know people in this business. It's right. People. And today, I used to sort of feel like people should make it easier. I understand why people don't make it easier today, because at the end of the day, and this is again, you know, my two cents, is that it's you're at risk. If you're a studio head and you're making 18 movies, you really can't, you know, look at 50 billion scripts out there. You have to have a process to make your job viable. I forget who said this to me, but one of those AFI seminars I went to, and it was like 30 people around, it was two studio execs, and they each talked about what their studios were looking for, and then three people would pitch stories, and they'd talk about why the story would or not work for them. I forget which, I went to a bunch of these. One of the execs said, the next day, I got 29 phone calls saying, can I come meet you? I have 30 projects that you're going to love. And they said, what you did, Sunil, was you wrote a letter, you came and met, and then you waited 3 months before you sent a script. And, you know, and then the script was really good. And then right away, it's that process. And that's why I'm always saying to people, make sure what you're doing is competing. And if you're newer to the game, just know it's a little bit of a, you know, it's people will always work with people they know. And so, you know, if you've just written a straight down the middle horror film and you don't know anyone in Hollywood, why do they need it from you when they have 30 straight down the middle horror films they're making with people they trust can do it? Again, my whole two cents is just how do you distinguish yourself and compete in the marketplace? And it's actually not as hard as I think I'm making it. I mean, am I making it sound hard? Or I actually don't think it's that hard. It's just a way to think. You know?
I do think becoming that version of yourself that can live. It's so weird to explain. You have to really live. The Hollywood life, I guess, is the way to put it. You have to be a producer. You have to be a director. You have to be an actor. And you have to understand what being those things means. And once you understand fully what being those things mean, it's not hard. It's just a job. It's just tasks you have to do, things you have to do. But you understand them. Understanding that is what's hard. Becoming that is what's hard.
I totally agree. And a thing, and I think again, a lot of writers, for example, that succeed in Hollywood started on an agent's desk, especially a few years back. And so they were, what advantage they got is they got to read the 3,000 scripts over a year or two or three of what else is selling. And so when they're writing knowing what that marketplace is, you know, what is a script that, you know, works for certain buyers, certain things, all of those things. And as a producer, I'd say that, like, when you get to the big studios, and I don't mean this in a negative way, I just think they're only going to work with tried and true, you know, producers who they know can deliver the film. And so if you're a young producer, a young writer, your job should be to go partner with one of them to get it into the system. And same thing with like an independent film. I think people don't realize that, you know, even when you're going to sell your independent film, there's only so many distributors, even distributors that distribute straight to digital, the good ones, you know, there are a lot of them. You know, the good ones get your film, you know, iTunes, Amazon, at, you know, really good placement, all of those different things. And they only have so many slots. And so they tend to work with people that they know can get from the beginning to the end. You know, it's that's why, like, my big two cents is always saying to people, like, just know what the market is and adapt. And then how do you, you know, retro engineer what you're doing, whether it's, you said, whether you're a writer, director, producer, actor, that's more interesting than what else is out there, you know?
And what do you suggest, not that you necessarily know, so this is an opinion, but what do you suggest the market's going to be once this ends, once we're able to leave our homes?
I mean, I'm going to always say, do things that distinguish yourself, differentiate yourself. Differentiate and elevate are two of my favorite things to myself. How is this differentiated than everything else out there? And again, it doesn't have to be perfection. I think people sort of have this idea that if you have perfection, it can sell. Sometimes they go too far that way. But elevate it. How is it differentiated? How is it elevated? All three of my little movies got a lot of traction, you know, at the agencies, with big agencies, you know, letting, you know, their clients meet and ultimately, you know, be in the film. And it's very, very, very hard to get small movies any traction at all.
Right.
I have a movie, I can't say who the cast is right now, that should go sooner than later. But at the end of the day, even that one, you know, we have a nice cast, but to get the traction is never easy. It's also a business today. I think so many people will write a script and be like, if I can just get this into X's hand, they're going to love it. But it's also a business. It's people do things for reasons. It's very easy to like project onto a big star why they would do your project. And I always say to people, like, look at what they're doing and understand what that marketplace is. Again, Salt was a script floating around for 8 years. Truly, there was not a lot of interest on it. I loved it. I developed it. I loved it. I kept saying, this is so good. People were like, well, you don't know if you're rooting for or against him. Is he the Russian spy? Is he not? It should be more action. I'm like, I'm the one who took all the action out and made it, is he or isn't he? And everyone's like, yeah, that doesn't work. And then suddenly Amy Pascal loves it, buys it for a lot of money. And it goes from kind of like, yeah, this doesn't work, to the hottest thing in town. And that's how suddenly you're meeting with Gerard Butler. And then obviously Tom Cruise, and then Angelina came on. And so part of it is a, you know, how do you get the powers that be excited? Even the press, I would say this right now, that, you know, when you're marketing a film, the press likes bigger names. Press likes, you know, everybody wants big names, tried and true. It's you know, even getting into festivals today, look at, you know, anyone can go look at what gets into a festival. It's a lot of big stars.
Right. I want to
add to this conversation though, because you were saying before, Sunil, like, am I explaining this? Is this simple enough? And I think when you're trying to differentiate yourself in the marketplace, it doesn't necessarily have to be an enormous shift. Like, even a small shift can make a big difference. Like, just with spy intervention, like, how do you approach the spy genre that's so tired and so done? How do you just approach it a little bit differently? And the twist that you guys put on it, which was very subtle, and it's about the director's treatment and how you're shooting it and the visuals and the story. But like, it's not a huge departure or a huge shift. So I think it's small ways you can approach it, right? And look at how do we shoot it differently? How do we tell the story differently?
Absolutely. And look, with spy, it's an interesting one because, you know, Milroy really had this sort of handcrafted approach. Let me do something original and different. And I'll tell you, it ends up having a lot of interest. It's done really well. We actually kind of believe it's going to hit a cult classic level. It's such an enjoyable original movie, you know, but the effects are, it was a bit of a challenge. Like, even when we got the trailer out there, even getting press to run the trailer, the effects are purposely kitschy, very curated. They're not supposed to look cheap. They're supposed to be as if the whole movie is like in a diorama, and allows the comedy and the performances and other characters are in on sort of the joke, which just makes it highly, highly entertaining. But then it's also original, and so you're trying to tell the press and everybody, here's what we're doing. We succeeded in that, but it's a lot of effort. And that's the thing, too, that I would say is like differentiate, elevate, and then no, you may still get attacked, and stand by your vision and your passion, and you will get there. You know, I do believe Drew Milroy is going to go on to be a big, exciting A-list director in Hollywood. I think Van Acker is going to be a big movie star. You know, he and I are actually developing a bunch of things together right now. And all of this came from, you know, literally nothing. It's you know, how do I say this? Differentiate and then sell what you've done and make sure what you have done is rock solid, and you can and you will win, is my two cents, you know?
Yeah, what would you say, because you talked about how you're less inclined to do television. Why is that for you?
I sold an ABC, a pilot to ABC a few years back. This is like 2010. I spent a lot of time on it. It didn't go. And what I found is, you know, most of television is, you know, they have all these deals with ABC Studios called pod deals and all these people that they have to make television with. And so for me, I just feel like I don't want to compete with that. So if I'm going to do that, I should partner with one of them and then go do it with them. I'm in a weird middle ground, which is, you know, I'm not opposed to partnering, but I'm at a place where I kind of want to do my own movies. I want to build my movies and my business as opposed to partnering with others. Now, I will say on all my big studio movies, I definitely had partners and they were great. But at this point, I do want to do my own. And I just feel like it's very, very tricky to compete. You know, most Netflix has deals with so many huge, 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 you know, major names in television. You know, there's like, you know, 10 or 15 big brands and then another 100 smaller brands in TV. And I would encourage anyone who's creating a TV show to partner with one of those brands. And that's how you get it through the system. Listen, there's no rules. The beauty is William Goldman was right. Nobody knows anything. So I'm just saying my perspective on it. If I did a TV show, I'd want to, you know, do it on my own. But again, I'm a producer. And so, and I don't, it's just harder. And so I understand features. I understand how to market features. I was very involved in the marketing of Premonition, Enchanted Salt, and then my three little films. I know how to make movies. I understand budget and schedule. I understand how that affects creatively. I understand acting. I'm blessed to have worked with 8 Oscar-winning actors, you know, 5 Oscar-nominated editors, 1 Oscar-winning DP, 2 other Oscar-nominated. I've worked with some of the best of the best, and so I just feel I can bring more to the table in the feature milieu. Television is a slightly different animal. Even the whole thing of like how at the end of each episode you want something that draws them back to the next episode, it was probably not as much me as like a classic 3-act structure for a screenplay.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah,
or the commercial out back then always annoyed me. You know, you have to, you know, someone has to be told that their brother's really their wife's cousin's alien sleeper spy right before commercial break.
Yeah, it seems that if you're going to do TV, it seems the most creative space to do it is nowadays with streaming. So you don't have to work around the commercial break structure and all that. You can. They seem to be giving more freedom to streaming and then paid cable shows.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But even that, and again, there's no rules to get on the air how you can. Again, if you're newer at the game, I'm going to always say figure out a way to get it to the right person or get an element attached that makes them need and want to say yes. I mean, that's another big thing that probably I didn't understand way when I started and understand it way better today. It's how do you put something in front of someone so they want to say yes? And I always, Hillary, I think I said this to you the other day, which is I think the mistake too many people make, and I've definitely made, I only say mistakes others have made if I've made them, is that people, they project how they want reality to play itself out as opposed to, like, let reality influence them to how they act. It's almost like you're backwards. It's, again, it's that thing where, I mean, look, you make a movie with Angelina Jolie and 10,000 people say to you, Sunil, I have a script and I just know if you can get in front of Angelina Jolie, she'll love it, you know?
Yeah.
It's the amount of scripts, and some of them, I mean, I want to say, like, people, it's like, I have a script about, like, you know, the worst idea you ever heard, but they were certain that Angelina, if she just could read it, would love it. And, you know, it's just, don't project your reality on everybody else. Look at what the reality is and use that to inspire you to conquer, you know, what's in front of you. What is the hurdle in front of you and how do you make that happen? You know, it's a little bit like right now, you know, it's actors and actresses. I always say to actors and actresses, what makes you unique? Because if there's, you know, 90 people who go in who are exactly alike for an audition, it just, the numbers are against you, but you go in and it's very unique, you're going to be more interesting. Same with writing, same with directing, all of the above, you know?
That's great.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Adding on to that, Sunil, you once gave me a little piece of advice that I've been sharing with some filmmakers and people, and it's been really resonating with people about the industry today. I think you said something to the effect of, and you can correct me if you'd like, that Hollywood runs on buzz and FOMO.
Yeah.
If you can get something in front of someone and have some kind of momentum or some kind of attachment or some kind of interest, even not even a formal attachment, and you can make it seem like this project is unique and awesome and we have this momentum, then people are going to want to jump on the train. But if you're like, I have this great script, can you get it to Angelina Jolie? It's not as compelling of a sales pitch, really.
No, and you've actually brought up a good point. I think the world operates on buzz and FOMO today. It's I think the press does. I think if you're a doctor in the middle of America in a lab and you have a huge breakthrough on coronavirus, I don't think half the press is going to listen to you today. It's not until you get somebody legitimate to back you is anyone going to listen to you. And part of what the game has become of modern business is that, you know, we're a corporate culture today where everybody wants backup and substantiation. Nobody wants to read a script at a studio and say, this script is brilliant, I love it, so I'm going to make it. Or, I love that actor, but he has no numbers behind him. People want data today. They want something, and buzz and FOMO is a big way to make up for that data. Do you want to hire this, do you want to buy this script because I have another offer? Fear of missing out, boom, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. I meet too many newer up-and-coming talent who I think are awesome, but a lot of talented, you know, newer people don't understand that nobody cares that they're great until you make them care. And that's sort of the big, you know, two cents I'm always saying to people is how do you make someone care? Because nobody really, I feel, wants to make a decision because something is absolutely great. And, you know, it's I want to go back to, you know, my lead in my last two movies. He kicked around for a few years. He's still very young, but he was on Pretty Little Liars and Devious Maids and Training Day. But there was nobody anywhere saying this guy's a movie star. After these two movies, you know, everybody is like, he's a movie star. One sold a Lionsgate. One sold a Cinedigm for even more money. Now there's a bunch of data, a bunch of press, a bunch of things that substantiate, you know, what was always there, but that's the difference a little bit is, you know, take what you have, whether it's a script, whether it's a, you know, I've always said to Hillary too, you know, if you're a writer director, come up with a minute and a half sizzle reel that blows people out of the water, that's unique and different, you know, and just remember, when you're submitting a script, whether it's to an actor, whether it's to a financier, whether it's a studio, they're getting 10,000 of these. And so how does yours stand out? And I think that's what people always forget. And again, actors, I would say this again and again too, which is, you know, if you're doing it exactly like it is on the sides and they get 100 auditions in, they're going to like literally have their eyes glazed over when you go end up, unless you have buzz or a name that makes them hire you. And so if you don't have that buzz, how do you, you know, create a material that gives you the stacked deck to get people excited to then start building that buzz?
How is it?
Before you jump in, Matt, just to add one little tidbit to that, my favorite analogy that you have told me, Sunil, that I freaking love is Hollywood now feels like 10,000 ants that don't want to build a hill.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that's the world, by the way. Like, but
the onus is on you as the creator. The onus is on you to do your work and come prepared and not hand off something and hope it ends up in the right hands. Like, you've got to come to the table ready to go as the creator. Right?
Absolutely. In every which way, shape, or form. And never wait for something to happen. It's whether you're a writer, producer, director, actor, don't wait for the phone to ring. Go make something happen. You know, one thing I will say pretty openly for any of your listeners is, one thing that matters more than anything today is money. If you have access to someone who could co-finance a movie, if you're a writer and you have $1.5 million film and you can raise $250,000 even, raise it, because when you're going after money, it's going to completely change. Oh my God, he already has 250. I'll put 250. And then suddenly it becomes infinitely more interesting to people than just a script. You know, I will say agents today, if you have a financed film for real, is infinitely more interesting to them often than, absolutely, agents package projects with directors and actors that aren't financed, and then they build the financing. But it tends to be bigger names, like a writer that just won an Oscar, a director that's thrown one at Cannes. And so they know that this package will get the money, so they're not wasting their time. You know, I just think, again, every agent who reps any actor with even a half name is getting too many scripts that aren't financed. And it's, you know, they can't, unless, I think there's sort of a misnomer, but what if that actor loves it? Well, first you have to assume, did that actor read it, you know?
Right.
Having worked closely with a lot of actors like go movies. They like things that they can make. As opposed to, you know, the other way around. I want to even say that even when I gave Van Acker Spy and he read it, and then his agent was helping us a little bit put it together, probably the first 2 months of that 3 months, whenever I would see him, I'd be like, okay, Spy this. He's like, no, let's not talk about Spy. Like, that's like way off in the future, because, you know, there was no reality that it was actually happening until that last month, and it all just came together. And, even directors, and I know a lot of my friends are high-end directors. I have a lot of friends saying, if you can just get this to Philip Noyce to read, you know, most high-end directors have 8 or 9 pet projects they're developing.
Right.
So they're not really looking for something else, in my humble opinion. It doesn't mean this is always the case, but they're not looking for another thing to kind of maybe see if it happens. So if a go movie from a studio or an indie finance company is in front of them, okay, I'll put mine on hold because this is real. That's just the thing to keep in mind too. A lot of this is timing. A lot of it is, you know, you have a great script and the actor you want to go to just fell out of a movie. They need something for him or her, and boom, here it goes. I want to say, all these actors on my film, Tom Cockrell, who's the star of Divorce Party, his manager at 360 is the one who suggested him. I was aware of him, but it was definitely a suggestion there. It was Drew Van Acker's agent who suggested him. And so that's how it's happened. I, in my opinion, even at the high end of the Angelinas, when their reps can kind of tell, I think this will happen, you get a yes. If a rep says, I'm not sure, it's very rare you outdo that. It's they all know how busy their actors are, what's on their plate. And so that's another big thing I'll say, is that like too many people wait for months from a response from someone when really it was a no before you sent it.
No, we had that situation before. I had that with CAA when we were trying to make Heart of America, and Peter Levine loved the script and we had financing. And then, and when you have the financing and you have an agent that loves a script, the whole agency will work for you. And when you lose the financing, which we lost, you lose all their interest. I guess my final question for you, Sunil, is now we keep talking about starting projects and projects getting made. How about all those projects that are, like you said, in the 90s, you had some in development, in all these projects in development. How can you push these larger entities that buy your projects or these producers that buy your projects? How do you keep the momentum going, and how do you get them to still want to make those projects? Like Enchanted, you said that was an 8-year process.
I mean, look, I think you're always selling as a producer your movie. Don't ever assume because someone says they want to make it, they're going to still want to make it tomorrow.
Right.
It's you're constantly reselling what you have and keeping them excited. And, you know, it's like Enchanted, there was a moment Rob Marshall was attached to it. Adam Shankman was attached to it. You know, Reese Witherspoon at one point was attached to it way back in the day. Again, that was a slightly different era, but ultimately on that one, it was simple. Nina Jacobson ran Disney. She'd always liked the spec script that Bill Kelly wrote years earlier when she was at DreamWorks. And, you know, she came into this project. She tried a few other writers. Most of the many writers were not on her watch. And I said, we want one more try with Bill. And this is why she's one of the just smartest, classiest executives and now producer I've ever met. Her feeling was, you know what? It was Bill's original. Disney took it away from him, all these other writers. It's not worked. For a small price, I'll take one draft, one shot with him. And if it works, I'll make it. And she loved the draft we did and greenlit it right away.
That's great. Well,
so you're always sort of figuring out how to keep people excited in every which way, shape, or form. And part of it is personal relationships. I will say the difference between the 90s and today is when I came to Hollywood, people lived and breathed their jobs in a very interesting way. Everyone went to lunches, dinners, drinks every single day, lots of networking. You know, everyone worked on weekends. Everyone read 30 scripts. It was a work ethic culture. Today, it's not quite like in that kind of way. So it's a little bit harder today for everybody to, you know, how do you get people excited? Back then, people were more open to it. Today, I'd almost say it's the opposite. But then just know that again, you're keeping everybody excited every single step of the way. And don't assume when you get a yes, it's even a yes. Always, even actors, you book a job. Too many actors, I think, have done this. Then they go do the job, but they booked it, got the money, and now it's just fun. They're not putting their heart and soul into it. Put your heart and soul into stuff. Like, you know, it's a competitive business where, you know, how do you show everybody that you're more interesting than everybody else? And I'll keep saying it. And again, on these projects with your bigger studios or bigger entities or even smaller entities, keep them interested. It's even in the indie world, I'm making a bunch of independent films right now, to keep people interested is its own art.
Mm, yeah, it sure is.
It truly is.
It sure is. Well, Sunil,
I think that's the work.
Yeah. Sunil, I just want to thank you for your time. And I think if anyone's trying to make films, especially independent films, this sit down with you is invaluable. I think, and it seems like you're just giving us some of the greatest hits of your advice. I'm sure you have a lot more you could give. Just outstanding. Really, really outstanding. I think you can ask Hillary. I don't think I've ever been so quiet during a conversation in my life. I'm just sitting
here
writing it all down, taking it all in, and I'm like, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
Hilarious.
Love it. I love it.
I'm a producer. I talk.
No. Yeah.
Can I tell one last quick thing, and we'll leave it at that,
sure.
Which is, one of my other favorite things about producing and writing and directing, I'll say this to everybody, is years ago, I was with the head of studio on a project and a director, and we had an actress attached. I'm not going to name names. And the head of the studio said, I don't want to make it with this actress. And the director said, okay, I think you're right. I think there's a lot better. And then the studio had ended up just shelving the project. A couple of years later, I'm at lunch with that studio head, and he goes, Sunil, why did you let that director say that? You wouldn't be sitting in front of me. I'm running the studio. I wouldn't have invited you in if I didn't want to make the movie. So when I say I don't want to make the movie, don't just agree with me. Fight me on it. That's what it was. I learned that years ago, and it's been one of the best things in terms of, you know, if someone is actually sitting down with you and engaging with you, that means they want to be talked into a yes. Never forget that.
That's a great piece of advice.
Even if they say, I don't want to make it, and I've had the, I don't want to make it, I don't like this, I'm not doing it with that person so many times. If they're sitting in front of you and engaging, like, talk them into it.
That's great. That's great. Someone told me that the other day.
That's something you've told me, Sunil. You're always like, I'll tell you the type of no that I got, and you're like, doesn't really sound like a no. That's a talk them into it kind of situation.
Yeah, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of it is just understanding all those instincts. But anyhow, that's my parting little words.
Whatever you've taught Hillary on that, she always says that to me, too. She's like, you know, we had this one script for a TV thing we were doing, and I took it to one of my showrunner friends, and I'm like, well, he loves it, and he gave us a ton of notes, and he thinks the script's great, but, you know, he's a straight male, and he doesn't think he should be making a show about lesbian women, and Hillary's like, I don't know if that's a no. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, well, I don't know how to turn it into a yes.
It's you can tell if it's a yes if people start engaging back and forth. You know, I'm there's a book I'm trying to sell right now. You know, I'm playing at a bunch of studios, but one studio called. They said the reason they passed. I gave my reason, and they were like, "I actually agree with everything you're saying, Sunil, but for us, it's a pass, mostly because, you know, from book to script, what you're saying is great. We just don't want to take the flyer. If you had a script, I'd be much more interested because then I could say to everybody, here's what it is. But, you know, it's people I think are very good about a yes, no. Whenever it's the person, the studio head who actually makes the decision or an actor who has, you know, cast approval over another actor and they're showing up to a meeting to discuss, it's 100% talk me into
it. Yeah, you're right. You need to be, I'm not you. I need to be more aggressive with some of these things.
Yeah.
You know, I look at, I'm blue collar from Chicago. So we look at these friendships as kind of like, well, this is your friend. You don't pressure your friend. You don't twist their arm. But, you
well,
know.
the only thing I want to say about that is with friends, where you've got to be careful, in my humble opinion, and again,
please,
everything I say is my opinion.
Please.
It doesn't mean I'm right or wrong. It's purely to make people think and make their own decisions. But in my humble opinion, what you've got to do with friends is, if it is a no, you've got to keep you got to let that go and let, you know, it's, I think there's a definite feeling sometimes when a friend starts to put pressure to do something that you can't do. And then it's like, I just think that's a tricky one too. And I think that's why a lot of people at powerful positions isolate themselves from so many people because they don't want to get to know somebody where suddenly you're in that position of having to answer. You know when it's a no, but know when you can talk someone into it. And it's instincts. And I always encourage people, and again, never project what you want out of somebody. Look where they're at and you'll know. You'll know whether it could be a yes, or you'll know, okay, that's really a no. And again, never let your ego get into it. Never let it be about how you feel. You know, those are my two cents. And when it's to be aggressive at the right moment is critical. I agree to, you know, if your friend is sort of half into it and you're actually going bending over backwards not to engage, you know, you should know that too.
Yeah.
I tend to, in the last 4 or 5 years, like I'm pretty direct with people, like, could be a great movie, not for me for this reason. And that's another big one, is most of us are pretty busy. Our plates are full. So we're not, like, I'm right now, I'd always take on a new project, but it has to somehow fit in its own unique way, different than the 6 things I'm working on right now. And
sure,
that's the trick of it. And it doesn't mean that what someone else has couldn't be brilliant. It's just, you know, you have to have the time and energy to, you know, pursue it. But anyhow, that's all wisdom according to Sunil, for better or for worse.
Well, thank you so much, Sunil and Hillary. Thank you so very, very much for your time. Hopefully we can do this again when this virus goes away and we can, or well, when this virus calms down and we can go out to L.A. and get together and have dinner and talk some more. I would love to hear more.
Absolutely. A pleasure. Let's keep talking.
Mine too. Thank you. Everyone
go watch Spy Intervention while you're locked
up. I encourage everyone. It's actually got 2 weeks on iTunes blacked out before the DVD release, but it is on demand, Amazon, everywhere else. It was on iTunes,
or Lifelike.
And Lifelike as well, which is everywhere.
Which you can check out Hillary.
Spy is on your in demand, so your big TV, you can watch it there, Amazon. And then in 2 weeks, Spy will be DVD and back on iTunes for rent. You can buy it on iTunes right now, but it's super expensive.
Well, thanks so much, guys. Thank you very much. And let's talk soon.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Have a good weekend.
All right. Thank you, Sunil. Bye.